Good evening, everybody. I think if you don't mind, we'll make a start because we've got a pretty packed agenda and I'd like to get into it. I should perhaps introduce myself. My name's Mike Aronson from Save the Children, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all here and to chair this evening's discussion. We are here to debate corporate responsibility and development. What can companies do to reduce poverty? Although our first speaker assures me that she's not going to answer that question, she's going to answer something else. However, I'll do my best to keep us on the straight and narrow. And this evening is a joint initiative of the Development Studies Association, the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at the LSE, and Save the Children. And I'd like to start just by thanking everyone from those three institutions who has worked hard to put this evening together. And we're very grateful to the LSE for hosting us here this evening. And the good news is that when we get to 8 o'clock, there will be a reception in the Shaw Library on the sixth floor, and I'll remind you of that when we come to the end. We've invited this evening speakers from very different viewpoints to get a discussion going, and when they have all made their presentations, which will be 10 minutes each, I will then open it to the floor, and I'd very much like to try to get a discussion going across the floor as opposed to between the floor and the speakers, because the speakers will then all have a final 3 minutes to sum up at the end. So they're all going to have an opener and a closer, and in between it's up to you. There are some journalists here, and they're obviously welcome to ask questions as well. And perhaps if everybody could just identify themselves, that would be helpful when we start. Now, I don't want to say too much now to get this going, but I think all I would say is that this is, for organisations, for all of us involved in development, obviously a critical question. I think it's fair to say that in the NGO world, the non-governmental world, there's been a very significant shift of thinking, and perhaps I would say even a sort of growing up in our thinking in recent years, where we've moved from regarding the private sector as being the enemy, the evil people who did unspeakable things in the pursuit of profit in the developing world, to actually being a key player in the development process. And certainly, as far as Save the Children is concerned, I mean, that's been our position for a long time. But I think, generally, there is now much more of a constructive engagement and a recognition of that critical role of the private sector, and all the figures about official aid flows and investment flows obviously make that point very well. And I think, therefore, the issue for debate is what are the boundaries, what are the parameters of corporate social responsibility? Does corporate social responsibility extend to tackling the root causes of poverty? And if so, given that more people are getting poorer and that traditional development approaches certainly have not yet worked, not on a large enough scale for today's population, what new models, frameworks, and partnerships do we need in the next millennium to alleviate poverty? And I think the sort of questions that we want to try to get at tonight are about the challenges that businesses face in answering those questions. What interest does business have in seeing poverty alleviated, and on what scale, and how are we going to measure what they actually do? So I think it's a very vital question, and as I say, we've got a good range of people all going to try to answer it from very different perspectives. And I'd like to introduce first Leslie Roberts. Now, I'm not going to go through all the stuff that it says on your, and I'm sure everybody has got the flyer for this meeting, and you can see that Leslie currently is an advisor to the Pentland Group and is very heavily involved in a number of initiatives. She's a statistician and an economist by training and by initial profession. She then, as she said to me, saw the error of her ways and joined Oxfam. She then saw the error of her ways and became the director of Anti-Slavery International. And I'm sure she wouldn't wish me to leave out the fact that she's also been, for a number of years, a member of Save the Children's Programme's advisory panel. Leslie.
Thank you very much, Mike. Yes, I did. As soon as Save the Children asked me to be one of the presenters here, I said, well, I actually don't like the question. And I think it's a very odd question, because if development is principally about the creation of wealth, which has to be represented by the production of goods and services, then only business can reduce poverty. Any development program, whether it concerns irrigation, nutrition, roads, education, health, improving agriculture, small businesses, and so on, can only be sustainable in the long term if there is an underlying increase in the economic well-being of the country. And it's fairly obvious, I think, that governments are not good at creating wealth. They're generally inefficient and too bureaucratic. Well, I would rather answer the question. I suppose, like most politicians, I answer the question I want to answer. How can companies, through their normal business, facilitate and encourage improvements in factory conditions and standards of living in the surrounding communities? And I think that last one is of particular importance to me. If we can't generate the changes in the factory, which will go further out from the factory, then I don't think we're doing a very good job. So I'll now proceed in the time available to ask the question. First, what is the Pentland Group? Most of you probably have not heard about it. It's a group of about 15 trading companies in clothing, footwear, and sporting goods. It owns brands, and I'm sure you know some of these, such as LS, Speedo, Kickers, Mitre, Berghaus. It also is a major sourcer of shoes and clothing for many retailers in the United States and in Europe, as well as the UK. And it is committed to implementing progressive improvements in the factories which make our products, which increasingly is in South Asia and the Far East. We are a member of the Ethical Trading Initiative, participating in a clothing pilot in China, the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum, and the Council on Economic Priorities. And I hope we take a very active role in all three of those. And I'll give three examples of how I think as a company we can have this larger impact. The first example is a sort of more traditional example, if you like. In Sialkot in Pakistan, we as Mitre, I'm talking as Mitre, not Pentland, have been buying stitch balls for over 25 years, almost exclusively from one factory. Through the business, improvements have been made continuously, and it is now one of the best, I won't say the best in Sialkot, I probably think it is, but I won't say that it is, it's probably one of the best in Sialkot. The business has been growing, and there is a stability with the relationship, which means that improvements can be made. There are still an incredible number of problems. In fact, I sometimes despair whenever I visit. There's conditions of work of home workers. There's the management of chemicals, casual workers, advances on salaries. But I think by continuing the business relationship, we can make improvements. And I have to say, in Pakistan, there's not an awful lot around that's helping a factory or a company improve conditions on these things. Example two, in Agra, in India, in Uttar Pradesh, where we saw shoes, there are many children working. They're working everywhere. As soon as you step off the train, you're aware of children working. In local restaurants, in shops and stalls, stone carving, jewelry, and in small workshops. They are not mainly in the export shoe sector. Most of the shoes made in Agra, about 90%, are for the local Indian market. They are made in small workshops, several thousand, where it is quite easy to find children, which I did on my last trip. During the last 5 years, pressure by export buyers has achieved child-free production in the export sector. We have had, however, little impact, or no impact, on the overall situation. Attitudes have hardly changed. In fact, I think they've almost become entrenched. The economics of child labor have not changed, and education facilities have not got a lot better. So what is our role? We have implemented our code. There are not children in the factory, not children under 14 in the factory. But I think we must and can do better. With our agent and a group of shoe exporters, we have established a code of practice on child labour and education. No children under 14 in the factory, and that includes on peripheral services. So children carrying in water to the workers, which was a very normal practice, is in many workplaces a normal practice, is not allowed, and we need to work with the people who are sending those children in with the water for the workers to see what we can do. 14 to 18-year-olds who are there legitimately are not in hazardous work, cutting operations and working with toxic chemicals, and they're not doing night work. And a clear message to workers that the education of their children is important, at least to the end of primary school and, if possible, beyond. And this is very important, a commitment from the factory that it will help with finance for able children to continue into secondary school and beyond. So there are at least three of our partner manufacturers who are actually who have actually got schemes going, helping not only children of their own workers, but also children generally in the neighbourhood. We're also working with them and local NGOs to improve facilities for vocational training for young people in the town, because the main problem area is age group 10 to 13, where they're dropping out from school. We recently started work with some research with a local NGO in a poor area of the town to map out the choices for families and children. It has taken us 2 years to get to this point to gain the factory's confidence that we are not out to find them out. We do not want to make victims of working children. Only by working together with the local factories and institutions we can make, I think, that extra difference. Example three is slightly different. Now, health and safety is usually considered easy. Safe workplace, tick on an evaluation sheet. Unfortunately, making shoes involves using a great many chemicals and solvents, many of them quite toxic. And when we ask people about the chemicals, and this is, I would say, is general, once you get outside Europe, so that's India, China, Vietnam, when we ask them about the chemicals, the answers were diverse. I don't have any chemicals. Over there are just glues and cleaners. Oh, we buy it around a corner. There's no information. Oh, we've been using it for years without any problems. Everyone has colds and headaches. It's normal. Clearly, we had a lot of work to do with providing information and training, and we've now trained over several hundred people, including managers and workers, on the whole area of toxic chemicals. And I'm saying we're only at the start of beginning to address this issue. Now, in Vietnam, the problem was particularly serious. The shoe industry is relatively new in Vietnam. The chemicals were mainly imported with little documentation, and above all, the information was not in Vietnamese. Workers were not informed of the dangers, either by the managers, who were in no state to inform them anyway, or the local union people. Factory inspectors lacked training in this area. Medical personnel in the factory lacked training in this area. Personal protective equipment, masks and so on, had to be imported, and compared to labor cost, very, very expensive. And there are no local laboratories for testing air quality. Samples have to be brought back to the UK for testing. You can imagine the cost of that. Now, this was clearly too much for us to take on in the 20 or so factories we are using and expect a lasting impact. We needed help. Over the last 2 years, we've been working on a project with the British and the Vietnamese government, which will be sector-wide. And I have to say, the first reaction of the British government on this one is, well, where's the poverty focus? And for the life of me, I really couldn't find it. And that's a real problem for us, I think, is actually trying to decide what is a poverty focus. Now, the project that we've got will run for 2 years. It'll be sector-wide throughout the whole of the country. It's being coordinated by the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum and sponsored by the major buyers, such as ourselves, Nike, and Adidas. I can tell you, to try and get competitors who are at each other's throats in normal business circumstances to cooperate in this way is quite difficult. And we hope that the project will be assisted by the World Bank and the ILO. One of the biggest hurdles was that the shoe sector was not considered hazardous relative to others. The government, however, was persuaded that this project could, in a relatively short time, strengthen institutions in the country to be able to tackle the more hazardous sectors where change would be more difficult. So we've learnt a lot. Do not come in with a preconceived agenda. you had told me 3 years ago that I would now be an almost expert on toxic chemicals in shoe factories, I would not have believed you. Codes can obstruct a more inclusive dialogue. I have no problem with our code or anyone else's, but a code is not an end in itself. It's a starting point, a statement of intent, a framework. A tick list of requirements is not working. If change was that easy, development agencies like Save the Children would have gone out of business ages ago. Suppliers need help. They need information. They need training. And we need a relatively stable but growing business relationship. The Far Eastern slump and present retailing conditions in the UK in the clothing and footwear sector are not helping. When a factory is at half capacity, improving working conditions is extremely difficult. And with local institutions, not back in the UK, we can identify problem areas and work together to find a way forward. We already have a major role to reduce poverty by promoting employment, but we can do more, and I hope that I have indicated how, in small and not so small ways, we can do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leslie, and thank you very much for sticking to time, which I'm sure all our speakers will do. Our second speaker is Colin Hines. Colin has been an environmental activist for about 30 years, including 10 years in charge of Greenpeace's International Economics Unit. He's the author of The New Protectionism, and I'll give a plug for his new book, which is out in March, called Localization, A Global Manifesto. He's an advisor to the UK Green MEPs, and he describes himself rather fetchingly as a mouthy heretic against free trade. Colin.
Okay, well, thanks from the heretic for being invited. I'd like to basically make sort of the inevitable three points. And that, first of all, is that globalization is not only a stupid and corrupting process, but it's also coming to the end of its useful life, and there is a growing reaction against it. Secondly, I'd like to explain some of the ideas that are now evolving to take us away from this fetishistic love affair with international competitiveness and back towards more local trade. And lastly, explain why, and this is the title I would have liked, we can go from ethical business, the noble exception, to the global rule. Because at present, we're bogged down into very noble exceptions because of the way things are organized. I've been sort of in the environment movement for a long time. I'm a bit of a sort of serial bandwagon jumper with a limited attention span. In population and then food and then nukes and then various things and enjoyed it. And it became evident to me over time that the big roadblock to achieving all these issue-specific end goals was the world trading system. Any trading system that forces countries to pit themselves against each other is not a system where you're likely to have an improvement in general poverty levels, environmental support, etc., etc. In fact, we're organizing things in an almost unbelievably stupid way. The world's gradually coalescing around trading blocks. And the trading blocks, take our own, Europe, you get together and then you break up barriers between you, so you all trade more with each other, you all try and grab each other's markets, and then, in the new Labour parlance, you become thrusting entrepreneurs with high-tech visionary futures, and then you're going to beat the crap out of all those other trading blocks. This is the future. Britain will be in the lead internationally competitive. Unfortunately, of course, the Japanese are being told the same thing, the Americans are being told the same thing, the Israelis are being told, everyone's being told the same thing. So somehow we're all going to win? It really is not a very rational way to organize things. And, before I came to this sort of center of economic excellence, I thought that it occurred to me that international competitiveness is now a new global theology. Everybody, every government, everyone has to bow down to this. This is the only raison d'etre for the organisation of a business or the organisation of a country or the organisation of policies. International competitiveness. So I looked it up in the Bible. I thought, if it's this much of a theology, it must be in there. And I went to the Ten Commandments. And do you know, this will come as a shock to some of the economists in this room, I'm sure. It's not there. Thou shalt be internationally competitive. It's not there. It's not there. It's a fairly recent construct that is very advantageous to a certain section of the world, elevated to a new religion. And it's extremely destructive. It is able to assert, or it's the WTO and its various advocates, are able to assert rising growth levels, rising stock markets, rising trade figures, rising income inequalities, rising poverty, rising unemployment, rising insecurity. There's a mismatch here. And there's a mismatch that is only getting worse. And the problem is that, unfortunately, instead of gearing economies to providing basic needs of countries, every country now is contorted and distorted in order to try and grab other people's markets. I think the most appalling way this is proposed is in this myth that the route to development for developing countries, and indeed now Eastern Europe, is to export to the north, and that the north must open up its markets to the exports of the south, thus putting people in the north out of work and pitting people in the south ruthlessly against each other. Yeah. I mean, the China's joining the WTO, boy, is that going to be a triumph for poverty within China and globally. Already we've had the biggest transmigration in human history. About 100 million people left the land to the cities. Once China has to open up its markets to dumped food imports, that'll increase. They reckon 150 million Chinese have got to leave, quotes, inefficient state sectors. Well, that's 250 million. That's 250 million people looking for a job. This is not a recipe for rising wage levels in China. It's a recipe for large queues who'll do anything, pay anything, work under any conditions in order to outcompete everybody else. And so the whole mentality is very, very damaging. But there is beginning to be a reaction to this. The whole idiocy of global world trade, the fact that people's desire, say in Europe, not to have hormone-fed beef rammed down their throat, not to have GMO foods rammed down their throats, that's bad. You can't do that. World trade rules. You've got to just keep the stuff coming, because the emphasis is on trade volumes, opening up markets. This is the way forward. But there is beginning to be a new concept of concentrating more on local trade. And the what's required is not a doing away of world trade rules. It's absolutely crucial to have world trade rules, but to change the end goal of those world trade rules. At the moment, at the top of the pinnacle of the spire of the theology of international competitiveness is the concept of reducing any protective barriers in order to you can go out and grab everyone else's market. Now, if you had a different end goal, and that was to protect and rebuild local economies globally, I'm not talking about Fortress Europe or Fortress US protecting itself and then still beating up the rest of the world, but globally you began to get a change in the end goal of the trade rules, such that there was a reintroduction gradually of protective barriers. Industry had to site in a country to sell there. Capital was grounded instead of destructively roaring all over the world. The environment was protected by the gradual introduction of resource taxes. And aid and trade rules were changed from their present destructive emphasis on ruthless international competition and returned to the concept of protecting and rebuilding local economies. Then you'd begin to have a much more sensible world. The problem is that many people think that globalization, well, like Tony Blair and Clinton and a lot of people, that globalization is like gravity. It's like God, it's inevitable, some natural process. It isn't. It's something that has been promulgated by the powerful for the powerful over a series of decades. And it's beginning to do very, very bad things. And so the concept of shifting that end goal to something very different is something that is now beginning to emerge. And the real problem for, say, ethical business efforts is really it's balloon squeezing. What you do is I work for Greenpeace, enormous effort on getting Shell to do something about Brent Spar and the Agonis. And it certainly had an effect, no doubt about it. Tremendous work. And other people do tremendous work trying to stop this product or that process of production, etc., etc. But they're always going to be unique little beacons. Because the general thrust has to be for companies to say, well, I'm sorry, I'd love to do that. I can maybe afford to have a couple of very well advertised instances of that. But actually, my purpose in life, even though personally I'm a good soul, nice to my family, and want the best for the world, my purpose in life, otherwise I'm fired, is to make sure my company is more ruthlessly competitive than any other company around. That doesn't leave room for very much more than small showpieces. Imagine, however, if you had a situation where the end goal of trade rules was to protect and rebuild local economies. Then suddenly, these options, a desire that products be produced in a way that supports labour standards, is helpful for the environment, etc., can actually happen. Because to try and lasso the trade tiger with ILO labour standards or environmental add-ons is literally like trying to lasso a tiger with cotton. It won't work. It's not what the tiger's about. What we need to do is to return the tiger to its natural habitat. The purpose of long-distance trade was the search for the novel. We didn't go to India to look for coal. If you have long-distance trade for things that can't be produced regionally and that they're governed by fair trade standards, then that's a useful adjunct to the major concept of your economy, which is to protect and rebuild itself regionally. It becomes the tail that doesn't wag the dog. At the moment, international competitiveness and this theology that there's no alternative to globalization is the problem, whether you're an environmentalist, whether you're someone concerned with development, whether you would like more money, say, for example, for any of the social problems we've got in this country, you have to curb public expenditure in order to be competitive. Say their children will never get what they want. So, just to sum up, the answer is the beginnings of a reaction to globalization. I'm off to Seattle, and there's tens of thousands of people going to be at the World Trade Organization in Seattle. It'll be the biggest movement since the nuclear days. And we're against free trade. Thousands of groups from all over the world have signed statements saying, no further liberalization. Let's revise and review. And the way you need to revise and review, I would say, is to protect and rebuild local economies. Hence, final plug for the book that'll come out in March, humbly entitled Localization, a Global Manifesto, How to Get from Here to There. And many, many more people, I think, are beginning to think this way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colin. Our next speaker is Richard Home, Lord Home, who, in addition to all the things it says on your piece of paper, is a Liberal Democrat politician. He was the chair of the General Election Committee. He's the Chancellor of Greenwich University, which houses the Natural Resources Institute. He's just become the chair of the Broadcasting Standards Commission. And he's on the council of the Overseas Development Institute, and he's also on the board of Transparency International UK, which is a non-governmental organisation tackling corruption worldwide. Richard.
Well, I'm afraid after Colin, I'm going to be very pedestrian and try in a sort of fairly understated way to suggest that there are some things that business can do. And of course, this is not just an academic question, because 5/6 of the investment in the developing world is now foreign direct investment, commercial and business investment. And so an awful lot of the world of development economics, which rested on government-to-government activity, is, if you like, subversively undermined by the fact that the reality of the modern world, of this global world, is that most of the investment flows into the third world are private. And therefore, it's an extremely relevant question for those who actually want to do something about the poor in the world to say, is there a way of working with business, and is there a way that business can work with public sector to try and make sure that Colin and I would agree on this, that although world trade, and I am unashamedly in favour of trade, I'm in favour of the free movement of people, the free movement of ideas, the free movement of capital, and I think free movement of goods goes with that. So I don't think we're likely to see a dramatic reversal of the fact that the world's becoming smaller, but it is a fair comment that if you look at the way the benefits of growth have been distributed, they have shown a bias against the poor, and I think that is uncontestable. So the question I'd like to ask is how do we identify what good business practice is? And we've heard some examples from Pentland. And then how do we try and generalize that? And are there some particular strengths in the way that business deals with poor people from which donors and NGOs might even conceivably learn something? It's true to say that a growing number of multinational companies at least now take these issues seriously, even if they didn't in the past. And their motives are mixed, as most of our motives in life are. Some are driven by criticism and fear of a globalized media and a loss of reputation. Some have identified that their license to operate depends ultimately on the support and consent of their neighbors around the world. Some companies believe that the creation of long-term shareholder value depends fundamentally on creating and sustaining a harmonious social context. And some companies now want to recognize multiple stakeholders explicitly alongside their shareholders. And of course, something that you ignore at your peril is that the new generation of managers coming into these large companies, about who I'll speak chiefly, have their own values, bred of their own generation, and they want on the whole to work for institutions whose values are reasonably aligned with their own. And these are all drivers towards a new attitude, as our chairman said earlier, on the part of business. So you get these terms like corporate citizenship, triple bottom line, corporate social responsibility. And cynics would say, well, it's all public relations. I don't believe that's the case. I think we are seeing a change in business, but a very uneven one, spotty, if you like, in which not all companies move at the speed of the best, and not the best are always good. There are also efforts at the supra-company level to raise the game. You may well have heard of the proposed global compact which Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, launched last year at Davos, which was attempting to establish a partnership with business around the world on the basis that the problems of the world are so pressing that if there are people with capacity and ingenuity and resources, it's probably better to try and work with them than to assume they're the adversary. Now, what I really want to spend my brief time talking about this is that every business has actually got choices. It's got choices to make day to day. And you can make the wrong choice by mistake or by a lack of care or even by recklessness. And the key thing about a company being a good neighbor is it actually takes forethought. So I want to contrast two companies, if you like, not particular ones, generalized ones. Let me just take the first company, which I'm going to call for the purpose of this evening, Bad Neighbor, BN Inc. This is a company that really doesn't want to engage when it's in a developing country. It uses expats in all the key positions. It has no local transfer of know-how. It gives only the minimal training necessary for relatively menial functions. Pays local labor minimum rates. Import materials without looking for local sources. Don't contract out to local suppliers. Evade local taxation as far as they're legally able to do so. Prepare necessary infrastructure with no local consultation on synergies, and rely on national agreements for their license to operate, rather than trying to get regional or local engagement in the host country. And if bribes are part of the way of getting through the bureaucracy, they pay them. They comply with environmental and other legal obligations, but resist any notion of compliance plus. What I've just described is quite literally a policy of separate development, a sort of socio-economic apartheid. And I can't say that never happens. I can think of companies in places who operate probably somewhat like that. But how would a company that was trying to embrace its responsibilities operate comparably? First of all, psychologically, a good company is going to recognize it's a guest, taking care to understand its host, to try and be sensitive to its culture, its way of doing things, without compromising universal standards, for instance, on product quality or safety or refusal to offer or accept bribes. Then in a very practical way, a good company will identify what could be done to help locally without being commercially imprudent. And I was very taken in that first presentation by this idea of things that businesses do intrinsically, can they do in such a way as to confer greater benefits on the surrounding community? For instance, by enhancing local skills and capacity inside and outside the company, by building local infrastructure, for example, power supplies or roads in such a way that local spin-off benefits, or by subcontracting supplies or maintenance to local small businesses. And to the extent that a company decides to invest directly in the well-being of a local community, say in improving education or subscribing to health care, trying to do this in a post-paternalist way by setting up working partnerships with agreed objectives. So I think this notion of partnership, if you're looking for practical ways of advancing this agenda, doesn't just apply at the global level of Kofi Annan trying to talk to large multinational companies through intermediaries such as the World Bank. It also applies on the ground. And I think partnership is logically the way forward. Most businessmen have a fairly realistic view of their own limitations. Not only can they not solve all the problems of the world or the local community even, but sometimes you have to recognize that there are problems created by investment itself, which need wider partnership to be resolved. Now, not all companies are good all the time, but when they make the effort to invest with care, to mitigate adverse effects, and do their best to multiply and gear up positive effects, what strengths do they bring to the development process? I believe there are several. The first and most obvious is that they're on the spot, committed to that location, living and working there, not flying in, as I regret to say some donors do, with prepackaged nostrums, but having to come to terms with the day-to-day reality of that place. Being there is a great strength to anyone who wants to tend and grow. So some businesses may be global in their reach, but it's only locally that anything happens, that widgets are made, that people are employed. Second, there's the fact that business is very accustomed to the idea of the development of human capital. So you don't start, you can't start with sociological generalizations. You have to start with an assessment of what skills can be developed and aptitudes fostered, and always ready to improvise with what's available on the spot. So the developmental model which comes most naturally to any businessman is the parable of the talents. We've had the Ten Commandments, it's time for the parable of the talents. And given that capacity is the single greatest need of most developing countries, it's highly relevant to what's required. Thirdly, the time horizons of business, and this is something that you may or may not have thought of, are relatively long compared to democratic governments who are seeking to renew their mandates every 3, 4, 5 years. And certainly the time scales of business are long compared to those of autocrats who are perennially looking over their shoulders. So investment returns for a company are measured in decades, not in months or years. And I believe that long horizons make for better development and forward planning, and for the whole idea of intergenerational transmission of skills and self-reliance. Fourth, the problem with any distant definition of the poor, in a sense the question we're asked tonight, is that it creates an anonymous collectivity, the poor. That's not a trap into which any local-based business is going to fall. Its potential neighbors, its employees, its suppliers, its consumers, those to whom it contracts out, are far more likely to be seen as the individuals they are. And finally, in attempting to analyze some of the potential strengths, and this may be a paradoxical thought to some of you who assume that business is more of a problem than an opportunity, but trying to analyze some of the strengths that business can, when it does it right, bring to the party, there's the sharp realism of self-interest. Now, I've been arguing for a long term, and therefore you might say an enlightened basis for self-interest, but we can't seek to deny it or suppress it. As our chairman said at the beginning of the session this evening, it is business activity, which in the end is economic activity. And there's a robustness about economic development which is based on self-interest, whether it's a woman market trader who's liberated by microcredit to sell the wares that she and her family grow, or a marketing cooperative for a fishing fleet. There's a realism about self-interest at work which makes it more likely to be successful. And my final word is this, Chairman. I am saying this from a business perspective. The poverty agenda, which DFID and the UN and others have adopted, I'm sure is the right one, but I'll simply say from the business perspective, how much more sympathetic the sustainable livelihoods agenda is, because businessmen tend to think that poverty is for someone else, for government, for NGOs, for people who do good, but not for them. But sustainable livelihoods, that they know about. And my hope is that to the extent that business becomes a partner in solving some of these problems, we can build on that notion of the creation of sustainable livelihoods.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. Our final speaker is Francis Stewart, who, in addition to being the director of Queen Elizabeth House at Oxford University, is also a council member of the Overseas Development Institute. Simon, you're doing very well. She's also a member of the UN's Development Policy Committee and the UN Research Institute for Social Development. She's, of course, well known as a development economist and as the co-author of Adjustment with a Human Face, which was a major work bringing to the surface and into the arena many of the issues that we are debating tonight. Francis.
I have further to walk, so I should be given an extra half.
I haven't started the clock yet.
Now, we all know that companies are increasingly dominant in the world economy, and we are told that they are also becoming increasingly social responsible. So the question we need to ask is, can we leave it to companies to cope with the problems of environment, to cope with the problems of poverty? Claire Short, in a way, has said we can. She said, sustainable competitive advantage means companies now need to be economically viable, environmentally sound, and socially responsible. And I think we want to ask the question, is that the case? Now, to prepare this, I read two books. The first one was by Mike Hopkinson, who's here somewhere, which is called The Planetary Bargain, Corporate Social Responsibility Comes of Age. And he quotes many examples of good companies, some with a strong concern for the environment, the body shop, some for labor standards, Levi Strauss and Nike, some for the community, the body shop again, the Grand Met. And he also argues that we have a win-win situation, and I think our last speaker was suggesting this, that companies who do good also do well. Unfortunately, some of the companies he quotes aren't doing too well at the moment, but maybe that's coincidental. For example, Sainsbury, Marks & Spencer, Body Shop, and even John Lewis has its problems. Now, the second book I read was called Dirty Business, and it was by Maurice Punch, and it contains examples of companies that have sacrificed safety for profit, for example, the Goodrich Brake, or the Ford Pinto model, or the Dalkin Shield, or the Herald of Free Enterprise, or thalidomide they might have added, or even Railtrack. Companies that have caused massive environmental damage, for example, Union Carbide in Bhopal, or Exxon in Alaska. And in fact, he ends by quoting someone called Clark, who says that crime and misconduct are endemic to business. Now, obviously, you don't need to go as far as that. Many of the bads that companies do are, to quote Amartya Sen in a different context, astonishingly legal. He could, in fact, the dirty business author, have included a whole lot of other things. He could have included the effective lobbying against generic drugs, which bring down the price of drugs for poor people, and in fact, companies have prevented quite a few countries from adopting this policy. He could have quoted the attempts to suppress local medical research or the production of cheap anti-AIDS drugs. And there's big movement in both South Africa and Thailand to prevent them producing drugs at a price of a dollar and instead allow the companies to sell the drugs at $14. He could have talked about patenting local plants and also even the human genome. He could have talked about dumping toxic waste. Texaco is currently being sued by an environmental group in Ecuador. He could have talked about tobacco. He could have talked for a long time about tobacco. He could have talked about corruption. Just since I started thinking about these issues, I've just been reading the Financial Times, and cases come day by day. There was one just on Friday about Lesotho water project with companies from Europe, Canada, and the US involved. He could have talked about financing war. Companies have financed Savimbi in Angola, and he's received altogether about $4 billion. He could have talked about the many lobbies for lower corporate taxation. And companies can justify many of these actions because it is their duty, their legal duty, to protect their shareholders. And so, on the whole, I very much agree with Colin Hines, who says that the socially responsible tend to be unique little beacons. And I think that is the case. Of course, there are examples of social responsibility. And I think it's interesting to investigate why they happen. What seems clear is that they rarely happen spontaneously and autonomously. There are a few cases. I think the Body Shop is one. But on the whole, they happen because they're forced to happen by outside pressures. For example, NGO pressure, which has led, as we know, consumer boycotts. Greenpeace is very notable on Brent Spar. There have been consumer boycotts for Nestle. Friends of the Earth have boycotted do-it-yourself supermarkets in order to stop them selling environmentally damaging tropical rainforest products. There have been lobbies against child labor in soccer balls, and so on. In pressure, very often the U.S. National Labor Committee campaign has had the U.S. National Labor Committee has had campaigns for higher labor standards in many countries, which in many ways is disguised protectionism and which has been very effective. For example, and there's been a strong campaign forcing Gap to have higher wages in the companies it operates in. There's shareholder pressure. We know the shareholder pressure on South African companies in the days of apartheid. And there are many ethical funds which are quite effective. There's media pressure, which has been very effective on safety. For example, again, the thalidomide case, and currently on the genetically modified foods. So these can all bring about change, and I think they're all very important. But they're all likely to result in partial developments, and the global companies, on the whole, may go about their business as normal. The problem is that you do need comprehensive government regulations or international regulations to bring about comprehensive solutions. And you need a macro environment which encourages socially responsible action and which encourages poverty reduction. Otherwise, you get very partial results. We were just told about the case of child labor in Pakistan, where you may rule it out in one factory, and in fact, you're pushing it somewhere else. Indeed, you can be even counterproductive. And here I'd like to turn just for a minute to the specific case of poverty reduction. I think it's much easier to see companies playing a role in environmentally sound policies and being pressurized to do so than seeing quite how these large companies are going to make a major contribution to poverty reduction other than by their normal business, clearly by creating jobs. And some of the products they produce, they are making a contribution to poverty reduction. But over and above that, can we expect them to make a major contribution? And I think the answer is no, because the people they cover are, in fact, the privileged. And you can increase the privilege. In the sense, getting a job, it may not seem that to us, but getting a job in a multinational company is a very privileged thing to get in most countries. And you may improve that privilege. You may improve the standards of the people in that company. But all the mass of people outside and the mass of children outside, their standards may well be worsened as a result of that. And in Bangladesh, certainly people argue that the efforts to get child labor out of many of the textile factories have in fact led to a big increase in child prostitution, pushed children into much worse situations because the basic economic motive for child labor remains. Poverty can't be tackled by companies directly. It must be tackled by governments, by improved infrastructure, by work schemes, by food subsidies, by education, by health. And what do we need for that? Above all, what we need is strong governments and governments which have got a lot of government revenue, taxation. And companies can play a big role there. They could pay their taxes. They could lobby for higher taxes. And if they did that, then they would be making a real contribution to poverty reduction and to the environment. They could also stop the many bads they're doing. They could stop selling tobacco. They could stop preventing generic drugs. They could stop financing wars. And they could stop corruption. All those would make a contribution to poverty reduction. So in conclusion, what I want to say is that you have to see the socially responsible company in the wider context. And you have to recognize that autonomously it's not going to happen. It must be and will be only under pressure. And that's where the NGOs come in and where we as consumers come in and where we as shareholders come in and so on. Under pressure, we may be able to get changes in company action, we may be able to get changes in government policy. But if we're going to do that, I think we have to be very careful, much more careful than I think some have been in the past, about defining the objectives in such a way that they will, in fact, lead to poverty reduction. And certainly, on the poverty reduction side, on the labor standard side, I'm not convinced that that is the case. I think that some of the objectives, such as ruling child labor out, is not necessarily going to lead to poverty reduction. It might lead to an increase in poverty.